It's the Burt Cohen Show. History is always so much stranger than fiction. We've been through so much very bizarre things in our past, that is of the United States of America, and we're still going through it. And, you know, how would you feel if your tax dollars were funding your enemy? Crazy, right? But apparently that is what's happening. According to our guest, journalist, author, independent scholar, Douglas Wissing, we are funding our enemy in Afghanistan. Doug Wissing, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Oh, thank you, Burt. Great to be on your show.
Well, with the vague intention of winning hearts and minds in Afghanistan, our guest, Doug Wissing, says that the U.S. government has mismanaged billions of development dollars, not just military dollars, development dollars, bolstered the drug trade, and dumped untold millions into Taliban hands. In his new book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban, investigative journalist Doug Wissing looks at how America lost the war in Afghanistan. He has the experience of going there and listening. Educated as a historian and political scientist, Wissing has scrambled over avalanche-choked passes and bandit-ridden corners of Tibet and into the far reaches of Afghanistan, often in body armor. Not something I would do. He's gained insight into Washington insiders, Hong Kong communist plutocrats, think about that, communist plutocrats, modern medieval armorers, and Belgian Trappist brewers who craft the world's rarest beer. His thought-provoking writing and meticulous research has resulted in 6 books and landed his unique perspective in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Foreign Policy Magazine, Salon.com, and on BBC, among other places. His award-winning articles and radio stories on Afghanistan have attracted wide attention among U.S. policymakers, perhaps not attention enough. And again, his most recent book is Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Doug Wissing, again, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. You've been to Afghanistan a number of times, even before the U.S. war after 9/11. What took you there back then?
Well, I've been interested in Central Asia for probably most of my life, and have spent a lot of time working in Tibet on various projects, and had written a book about an early explorer of Tibet, a very remote region called Kham. And I was interested in that part of the Himalayas, the far edge of the Himalayas, where it really kind of crashes into the Pashtun world, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that was what brought me there initially. This would be before 9/11. It was just right at the not very many years after the termination of the Soviet war. I was in Peshawar, which is the capital of the great tribal regions of Pakistan, northwestern Pakistan, that people often refer to as lawless and anarchic, whether that's sort of a misnomer. It's ruled under tribal law, but
just not our law.
At the time, Peshawar had millions of Afghan refugees. The Mujahideen were running around. The CIA was still running around. There were lots of very questionable aid workers that were involved with various things, and it was right before the Civil War started, and so the Mujahideen groups were kind of positioning themselves for what then became the great Civil War of Afghanistan that the Taliban arose out of. And that was what drew me there initially.
Sounds like a very different culture. I mean, really, just couldn't be more different from our American Western culture. And I imagine virtually nobody who's listening right now has been to Afghanistan. And on our mainstream media news, we get a fairly clear and pretty consistent message. Yeah, it's tough over there for our troops in Afghanistan. There are the occasional setbacks, surprises like a recent big attack, sort of a mini Tet. But in general, it's been a good thing that the U.S. is there in Afghanistan. And thinking about our understanding of that, the you know, what we get from the mainstream media, you learned a phrase there relative to this dissemination of alleged news. The phrase is feeding the chickens. What does that mean?
Feeding the chickens is the government's efforts to gather up the journalists and the media and to disseminate what they call success stories, happy stories, in the face of total dysfunction and a lost war effort. They distribute these happy stories. And the term that the Pentagon public affairs people use is feeding the chickens. You know, the journalists show up and they hand out the press releases, and the lazy journalists go off and publish that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the information that winds its way through mass media, that's the way it comes, through the chicken feeding process.
And we listen to it and we don't know any better. We're often surprised when things are different. You've been there. You've really traveled deep into the country of Afghanistan. And I have to ask, you know, you've delved deep and wide into that vast, vast territory called Afghanistan.
There is an Afghan nation that's been together really longer than most countries. And there is a sense of what it is to be an Afghan. However, that does overlay an extraordinary tribal society, a very opaque tribal society with hundreds of tribes and sub-tribes and family groups that are really the bedrock of Afghan society. And there are some tremendous rivalries between some of those larger tribal groups that underlay the civil war and underlay what appears to be the second civil war that's upcoming as the international forces withdraw.
Hmm.
People have a very intense tribal identity, and some people have argued that that has actually increased since the Western powers, the U.S., Russia, and the other folks around them have kind of turned Afghanistan into the devil's playground.
Hmm. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it was Winston Churchill who referred to Afghanistan as the graveyard of empires, and that's so curious. And, you know, we hear, we get the impression, well, there's President Karzai and these warlords, these bad guy warlords. I mean, just the term warlord. How are they, what's pictured here as warlords, how are they perceived over there? Are they called warlords? Are they feared? Or is there some sort of a fairly significant allegiance among the different tribes within Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know the Afghan, the Pashto, or the Dari word for warlord, and whether that is the term that's associated with leaders that often have, you know, the tribal, their leaders one way or another in certain kind of tribal groups, like General Dostum of the Uzbeks, or any of the others, Masood with the Tajiks, who passed away, but his family is still very powerful. But they serve a function as a big man, as a kind of an anthropological term for Central Asian societies, and that's a pretty traditional way of thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the question I think we have to ask ourselves is, you know, in some cases, these warlords, these are the people that we allied with to be able to throw out the Taliban after 9/11. And what has been widely discussed and researched is that, you know, these are essentially not only warlords, they're also drug lords. And they were the kingpins of the opium trade. And people tend to forget that the Taliban had virtually wiped out opium poppy production in Afghanistan. It was near zero when 9/11 happened.
Really?
And now, of course, Afghanistan produces, you know, the figures vary, but somewhere between 75 to 90% of the illicit opium of the world comes out of Afghanistan. I spent time down in Helmand, which is in the south of Afghanistan, just this last year in January and February. And, you know, people tell me about poppy production to the horizon, poppies to the horizon. I was thinking it was like, you know, farmers with hoes. This is like major production using tractors and whatnot. And, of course, all that is completely tied into the Karzai government and to powerful figures in the Karzai government.
And
So we tend to forget that those kinds of things happen. So we've gone from a virtual wipeout of the opium production under the Taliban to being the great producer of opium today after a dozen years of U.S. intervention.
That's really eye-opening to hear that. I had not heard that before. And, you know, one would think the U.S. government, at the very least, would not want to enable the more production of opium, which, of course, is the root of heroin. And so was it that the Taliban, given that they were, you know, very religious, fundamentalist, why was production of opium down under the Taliban? And why did it come back since the U.S. came in?
Well, by most accounts, the opium production declined because the Taliban are, of course, fundamentalist Islamists, and the Quran bars that kind of intoxication. Mm-hmm. And two, they really wanted international recognition. They were working very hard to get UN recognition, and there was lots of back channel communication between the United States, the State Department, and the Taliban, trying to come up with ways to do that. And of course, one of the things we wanted them to do was to reduce opium production, which they did. And the way they did it was they got rid of a lot of the old warlords, the Mujahideen that we had paid, that we had allied with during the Soviet War. These were our boys. And the Taliban, one of the things they wanted to do to reduce the anarchy in Afghanistan because of the Civil War was they had to get rid of these old warlords. We then essentially re-empowered them when we decided we were going to invade. But that was the way they did it. They got rid of the opium drug lords, who were the warlords, the Mujahideen, and they were our guys.
And you've talked a couple of times here. You've talked about the Civil War. I thought I knew a little bit about what's going on in Afghanistan, but which Civil War? You talk about two Civil Wars. Maybe you can define those terms just briefly.
Well, there was a very intense and violent civil war after the Soviets pulled out in 1989. So there had been a shadow war between the United States and the Soviet Union over Afghanistan that lasted essentially from 1979 to 1989. And there's a famous, a lot of people have seen a movie called Charlie's War, which was based on a really great book by a good journalist called Charlie Wilson's War, that depicted our shadow war in Afghanistan against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. And then there was a book that was done, a great scholarly book by the journalist Steve Call, called Ghost Wars, that documented that extremely well. It's really an extraordinary work. He's now the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, Columbia University School of Journalism, and is a New Yorker writer and was the managing editor of Washington Post. Call is a tremendous researcher. So what happened then after the Soviets pulled out, we were pumping billions of dollars into that war. We were setting up the madrasas. We were funding the Mujahideen, the people that we're now fighting. We are the ones that armed them, we're the ones that trained them.
Right.
And And then after the Soviets pulled out in 89, we pulled out. And, we, you know, our support, USAID funding, everything collapsed. We walked away. We were done. And so what happened after that, this was, by this point, Afghanistan was among the most heavily armed countries in the world. There's only 25, 30 million Afghans. They had more personal armaments, AK-47s, rocket launchers, all that kind of stuff. They had more of those than the populations of India and Pakistan combined. So that's a population of well over a billion. So 25, 30 million people had more arms than well over a billion people. Mm. It was an incredibly heavily armed society.
Jeez.
And a civil war broke out, and they had, you know, it was a bloodbath, and went on for years and years. And then the Pakistani Secret Service, got very concerned about the anarchy at their backside. Mm. They have an existential fear of India that they face. They've had a couple of wars with India.
Oh, yeah.
The Pakistanis were terrified that they were going to have they were going to have this anarchy at their backside that could be then manipulated by the Indians. So the Pakistanis empowered the Taliban. It was a homegrown organization, but they helped fund them and organize them and train them. And the Taliban quickly took over Afghanistan. And things were actually pretty peaceful in those years where the Taliban were in power, those few years between then and 9/11. So I'm talking about the first civil war is that period after the Soviets withdrew. The second civil war that I referenced is the one that many, many commentators and many Afghans that with whom I spoke in Afghanistan this year, people are very fearful of a second civil war, or another violent civil war, and many are pointing to these old warlords are still around. It's remarkable. These same tribal warlords, with a few exceptions, are still around. And they've been positioning themselves to get control of the army, to get control of the arms. And, now we're talking about much heavier arms that are in Afghanistan, howitzers and armored vehicles and, you know, some pretty major stuff.
Mm.
These warlords are positioning themselves to get control of that and essentially put together their militias again. And so this, what I call Civil War 2.0, seems to be what we're looking at now.
If you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is journalist, author Douglas Wissing. His new book is Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. And again, the common perception is on one side, there's the Taliban. On the other side is President Karzai. Is that accurate? And what is the... I'm sure there's a lot of different opinion among the various different areas within Afghanistan, but how is Karzai perceived?
I can tell you that what soldiers told me when I first went out there is that this was all mixed up. They were telling me that the U.S. government was wasting tens of billions of taxpayer dollars each year on these scandalously mismanaged aid and logistics contracts that weren't helping the Afghan people. And then I spent most of my time embedded with U.S. soldiers out in the field, out in eastern and southern Afghanistan. We'd be out there riding around in Taliban country in these big armored vehicles, and the soldiers would be telling me that there was this toxic system that was connecting distracted American officials, careerists, private U.S. corporations, for-profit corporations, corrupt Afghan insiders, and the Taliban. The soldiers would be telling me, we're financing both sides of this war. We're funding our own enemy. Then I have seen more and more references. There is a term that's used out there a lot, which is called the man. We're looking for the man, because the military loves to make acronyms out of everything. And what the man is the term for malignant aligned networks. And that means exactly what I just described. These connections between our money that goes through the Afghans and ends up in the insurgents' hands. So we're really talking about this grotesque corruption, this greed by U.S. for-profit corporations, this kind of distracted war making by American careerists. You know, we've just wasted a staggering amount of money. The total bill for this war is going to be something like $1 billion. And we've had tens of thousands of American and Afghan lives destroyed by this war. And what we've gotten out of this, you know, you were talking about Karzai and Karzai's government. The Karzai government has been ranked among the most corrupt governments on the planet for years. It wasn't that way when we started. Afghanistan has never been this corrupt.
Really?
We did this.
Wow.
We enabled it. This is Afghanistan, a dozen years into this, a $1 trillion bill, tens of thousands of lives destroyed. They're ranked as the seventh worst failed state in the world. A third of the children in Helmand are malnourished.
Wow.
We have burned through $100 billion in aid and development money. This is a tiny country, the size of Texas, 25, 30 million people. You know, a third of the children are still malnourished. And this is because of what the term that's used, that when you and I met, we initially talked about this concept of phantom aid.
Yes. Phantom aid. Now, I had never heard that before, and I have to put in a plug for Where We Met, a wonderful barbecue restaurant, the Top of the Hill Grill on Putney Road in Brattleboro. An old friend of mine is running the place. Anyway, I had never heard of phantom aid.
And I just want to add to your praise of Top of the Hill Grill. It is just such wonderful food. Whenever I come to Vermont, it's John Julian is an old friend of mine, but
and mine.
I confess, I love John Julian, but I love his food even better. It's just such a wonderful place.
It is. It really is a wonderful place. The Top of the Hill Grill, Putney Road in Brattleboro. Neither of us has paid a thing for it.
No.
But
well, you like the food.
Oh yeah.
So going back to phantom.
Yes, aid. Phantom aid.
Yeah, this is a term that I encountered when I first started working on this. As I said, I was out there with U.S. soldiers. They were telling me this kind of wild story about us funding the enemy. And I started digging around when I was out there. And officers kind of like started admitting that, yeah, we were funding the enemy. And gosh, it was kind of fun. They didn't quite know what to do. Everybody knew this was happening. And the current guess is that about 10 to 20% of our money ends up in the Taliban hands. So at any rate, I got back, I started digging into just a mountain of government reports, so, you know, interviewing hundreds of people from ambassadors and generals down to grunts on the ground and development people who are working down in the trenches, and that was the case. But there was such tremendous dysfunction, we were funding our own enemy. And one of the terms that I encountered was phantom aid. And we do this thing, we've spent about $100 billion on aid and development.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of it has disappeared. And the term that the development critics use is phantom aid. So we think we're doing this nice thing. We appropriate this money to go do foreign aid. And what happens is that the money just disappears. It goes through a process of subcontracting. So projects are flipped. So let's say there's a project for $100 million, and it goes to a development corporation in Washington, the Beltway Bandits as they're termed, or Geneva or someplace like that, they grab it, they pull off 20% for overhead and flip it to somebody else. They, in turn, will grab their 20%. They flip it to somebody else. And it goes on down the line until somebody has to actually do something. There's one example that was done up in Balkh province, up in the north. It was a military contract to build 3,500 modular units for a base. And so the money went out to a politically connected Afghan firm. They were going to get $17,000 each for these little modular units. Well, they flipped it to a second firm, and the second firm was supposed to build them for $13,000 apiece. You know, so the first firm got $14 million for doing almost nothing. The second contractor, of course, immediately flipped it. Now it's down to $9,000 a container. When it finally, the flipping all got done, there was some poor fool down at the bottom who got $7,500 a unit, less than half the original amount, and, of course, built really bad unit. Mm-hmm. It started falling apart almost immediately. And this is the way it is. I had mentioned to you, Bert, there's this sort of famous story about a UN contract, a staggering amount of money. It was $150 million for a house-building project in Bamiyan province. Most people know about Bamiyan province because this is where those enormous ancient Buddha statues were blown up by the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is in Bamiyan province where the Hazara tribe is the dominant tribe. So this $150 million contract went to an aid agency in Geneva, which, as is the case, kept 20%. They flipped it to another NGO, another non-government organization. Mm-hmm. They took 20%. They passed it on to a third agency, which took their 20%. They subcontracted implementation to somebody else. So now we've got like a pretty small amount left. But this fourth firm, they at least actually bought some big wooden beams in Iran. And they were going to haul them up to Bamiyan. Well, the warlord, the Afghan warlord over in that area, in around Herat in western Afghanistan on the Iranian border, is a guy named Ismail Khan, infamous warlord over there. Well, of course, he wanted his trucking company to get the contract to haul these big Iranian beams up to Bamiyan. And so his trucking company got the contract to haul it up there for five times the normal rate. So, you know, it's like lots and lots of money. So we finally get timbers up to the Bamiyan villagers to build their houses. Well, the local tribesmen, they looked at these things, realized they were far too heavy for typical Afghan mud wall construction, so they chopped them up for firewood.
You know, it's funny, but it's amazing how, you know, out of touch apparently we are. That's just an amazing story. And just to think that how much did that whole thing cost U.S. taxpayers, do you think?
Well, that particular one was a U.N. contract. And, of course, the U.S. is the major donor country with that, particularly now for any kind of Afghan project. We're dumping more money in Afghanistan and Pakistan than any other place in the world. It is just staggering, the amounts of money that are being poured in and doing no good. I mean, I think we all understand sacrifice. And,
sure.
You know, most people have a humanitarian urge to do something right. But what we're seeing is it isn't helping the Afghan people. As I said, a third of the children in Helmand, this is a UN study, a third of the children in Helmand are still malnourished. And we're paying for $500,000 development consultants coming in. We're paying for, if people had any idea of how this, the term is the burn rate. Mm-hmm. These development organizations, USAID and the State Department, the Department of Defense has lots of development stuff going. And the term is the burn rate. You have to burn your budget.
Uh-huh.
You know, as being a state senator, I know you know all about the burn rate and how agencies are determined to spend their budget, lest they lose it in the next year.
Right.
Well, this is on a staggeringly large level, and that's the way it goes.
And, you know, a lot of people have known for a long time from the war in Afghanistan and from previous wars that, you know, Afghanistan is not a place where the U.S. can win militarily. It just, and that, you know, it can't be done. And that there was a correlation between development aid and a reduced insurgency. I mean, even somebody who I really looked up to, George McGovern, used to talk about, you know, he used to say when we were fighting communism that we could do more to dry up the swamplands of despair that breed communism with, you know, we can do more with our agricultural aid, our educational aid, medical aid, etc., than with all the military hardware in our huge arsenal and do it more cheaply. So, you know, there has been the belief that especially in Afghanistan, where there is tremendous poverty, very widespread poverty, that you know, development aid can do something, can help.
You know, that was a big eye-opening part of this research on the book, is what I discovered is that there is no evidence there is no research that indicates development funding increases security. And that's what the way it's been sold to us. And if anything, the research is indicating that the disbursement of development funds can increase insurgency because it's so destabilizing. We don't have a clear idea of these cultures. We come in, we dump staggering amounts of money by their standards into these societies, and it just becomes this enormous grab for resources. The very wealthy people get it. That's, of course, what we're seeing in Afghanistan. So there's really no evidence that development funding improves security, and there are academics an increasing understanding of this. And speaking of Vietnam, the Vietnam era, as you spoke about with George McGovern, the military still uses the term winning hearts and minds.
Yes.
And being the military, they, of course, have an acronym. We would be out on WHAM missions, winning hearts and minds missions.
I hadn't heard that term.
And, you know, WHAM doesn't work. And counterinsurgency, that was a big part of General Petraeus' gig, this winning hearts and minds and nation building. And it didn't do it. And what we have discovered now is the U.S. military in Afghanistan couldn't kill its way to victory, nor could it buy it. This just didn't work. And counterinsurgency coin is what the military calls counterinsurgency coin is now a dirty word in Afghanistan.
Hmm.
You don't want to talk about winning hearts and minds. You don't want to talk about nation building. It has been an abject failure. It's subject to all of these money grabs. Things got completely out of control. The for-profit development corporations have left a totally unsustainable infrastructure. Roads falling apart virtually before they're done. School buildings without teachers. Clinics without doctors or any kind of paramedics. I was with one development military group in Host Province, out a very wild Taliban-controlled area, Haqqani Network-controlled area in eastern Afghanistan, just along the Pakistani border. And this military team was a development team. It was an agribusiness development team, an extraordinary idea to take National Guard units, whom were trained soldiers, but also had all these civilians with various kinds of very specific expertise, as in agriculture. And so these were hybrid units of about 65 people. There'd be two-thirds of them would be security soldiers to protect them. The rest were experts that would go out into Taliban villages, go out into insurgent-ridden areas, and attempt to do development, help villagers, help them incrementally increase their stuff. It was a great story. I spent lots of time with agribusiness development teams all over the war zone. And, you know, I can speak so highly of their courage and their intent to do the right thing. And, man, it just doesn't work. You know, these were the best people I could think of to do this thing. They were, you know, civilian soldiers. So they weren't just military guys. They understood this thing. It was farmers talking to farmers. It was, you know, they had the right kind of money. They were trying to do the right kinds of projects. They weren't trying to overload the system with money. They had the security to be able to travel. I mean, if there was, you know, anything that could be done, I feel like these people could have done it. I've spoken highly about these people, and it just doesn't work. It didn't work. Of course the Afghans would take our money. It was staggering amounts of money. It was hilarious amounts of money. I mean, we would be doing projects in villages that I am certain they have never seen that much money totally in the 2,000 years that village might have been there, you know, and it would be a two-month project. And, you know, our people just, people in Afghanistan make $400 a year. It's a subsistence society. They kind of quietly starve in the winter. It's one of the lowest caloric intake societies in the world. But it's a very stable society. The Pashtuns, it's a thousand-year-old society, a very strong, very stable society. You know, and we were just destabilizing everything. We were igniting corruption. We were, you know, we would do things like dig wells. What could be nicer in an arid place than to dig a well for a village? We did it, the UN did it, NGOs did it, you know, all kinds of military units did it, USAID did it, State Department, everybody was digging wells. We dug so many wells, we lowered the water table. So traditionally, fertile fields became totally barren. It's like there's a great book that came out by a professor at George Mason University, and the title is Doing Bad by Doing Good, which is a very academic inquiry into the things we're talking about here.
Mm.
And that's the case. There are a lot of academics that are coming out with a greater analysis of really what is the sustainable thing that can be done, and what do we really get out of this? And we are finding that it's not nearly as successful as we had hoped it to be.
Well, that word sustainable is a big word these days, and it probably will be for the remainder of the 21st century, as far as I can see, here in the U.S. as well as throughout the world. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Douglas Wissing, author of a new book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. I wonder about the decision-making process regarding development projects funded by we, the U.S. taxpayer. How much local involvement is there? Is there a built-in process whereby we ask them what they want, how we can be helpful, what we can do for them? Tell us about the decision-making process regarding these projects.
Well, it shifts around a lot. I mean, people have said we haven't had a 12-year war in Afghanistan. We've had 12 one-year wars in Afghanistan. So virtually with every change in the military commander, every change in the head of mission for USAID, for each new ambassador, of course, the change in administrations in Washington, you get massive shifts, very little institutional memory, institutional history. So, for instance, I was in Zabul province, which is an area down in the south, a Taliban-controlled area. And the development soldiers there were talking about building a new slaughterhouse, which was another very, very expensive project by Afghan standards. The Afghans typically slaughter out in the fields, slaughter in the streets, and this is our way of thinking, well, we can do this better. So, of course, it's a giant contract that goes out to a for-profit development company who subcontracted a few times. Somebody builds this thing. Well, they had to abandon the slaughterhouse because they had built the floor with ceramic tiles that had a raised surface to it. So, of course, all the blood and all the detritus got stuck in this tile. And this one development soldier who was a professor of veterinarian science in Mississippi, he started shuddering and he said, it was a wall of flies. He's like, you couldn't walk in. And I said, so what happened to the first slaughterhouse we built? And everybody in this military unit just froze, and I could see people like their eyes are bugging out. And they said, how'd you know about the other one?
Yeah.
And I said, because that's always the way it is. We build one, 2 or 3 years, it doesn't work. 2 or 3 years later, a new group comes in. Nobody remembers the first one. We build another one. They said, yeah, that was exactly what happened. And this is the way it is. There's no overlap. There is no central coordination. I was out with another group in Host Province, where they were this team was going to do animal husbandry projects, and they knew USAID, our foreign aid group that's attached to the State Department, had built a series of veterinarian clinics through this province, this small province. A number of them, 12, 20, something like this, throughout the various districts, probably one in each district. There were 13 districts, as I recall. And so, there are all these little villages. The soldier from the military unit goes to USAID, and he said, well, listen, we're going to use your paravet clinics as our base in each one of these districts to do our projects. And so where are they located? And the USAID person said, we don't know. We've lost the list. And the man who was asking him, he was a National Guard guy who happened to be a prosecutor in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
He dealt with murder cases. He was a really dogged prosecutor. He had cracked cases nobody had ever thought could be solved. He said, we're the military. We can find these things. Can you give us coordinates? Can you give us anything? And the USAID, these things were built 3 years before. He said, no, we don't know. We've lost, our our hard drive crashed. We've lost it. And the guy, the prosecutor, the soldier, he kept after them. He was used to getting answers. So finally they dug through this container, found a list. They finally had them. So this Army unit, who has their own security, who can travel in convoys of armored vehicles with machine gunners on top, they start coursing their way through the project to find the clinics to begin their animal husbandry. What they found is virtually every clinic had been looted. Everything was gone. The solar panels were gone. The refrigerator was gone. The windows were gone. In one case, the entire building had been stolen. Yeah, it's just like, and this is,
oh my.
This is not unusual. This is the way it went. This is the way it went all over the place.
Well, when I did a little, publicity, for this upcoming show, I put it out on Facebook, and somebody wrote back, a guy who had served in Afghanistan, and he said, just like in America, I'd like your reaction to this, Douglas, just like in America, all we have succeeded in doing is concentrating the wealth in the top 1% of the and the population suffers. I knew one Afghan contractor who was paid $80,000 monthly, U.S. dollars, to pump the septic tanks of all our latrines, and he had a contract for several bases, but hardly $80,000 a month worth. He rarely, if ever, paid his workers, yet even knowing he wasn't paying his workers, the U.S. kept sending him his paychecks. It was like that with all the Afghan contractors. I'm getting the sense that this is not at all atypical.
This is a major kleptocracy. This was ranked as the most corrupt country in the world.
And again, the decision making. You would think we would go in, respectfully and ask the people, "Hey, you know, we can help you here. What do you need?"
Well, we have done that. You know, it's called, putting an Afghan face on it, Afghanicizing our effort. That became, especially as the Obama administration took office, this became the great focus. Now, the problem we've got with that is so we're running now all this money through a kleptocratic government, and that works its way all the way down. And people would go to elaborate lengths to try and get Afghan buy-in, to get community buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
There would be shuras, the term for meeting. Lots and lots and lots of shuras. I mean, you could float a battleship on the green tea, drink in shuras with American soldiers and development officials to try to get Afghan buy-in. But what's really going on is, how can I maximize my take on this? How do I benefit me, my family, my cronies? And none of the sustainability, we're going back to that thing again. So much of this stuff is totally unsustainable. This is a very, very, very poor society, $400 a year. And we would leave them with, I'm thinking of like Army bases. There was an Army base where we were going to transfer to the Afghan National Army. And so we left them with this incredibly beautiful stainless steel kitchen with all the best stuff, designed to feed soldiers. Soldiers eat very well out there, American soldiers. I was thinking I was going to be eating ready-to-eat packs and things like that. No, the dining facilities are amazing. I mean, just amazing food. I can go on at length. But anyway, we gave the Afghan National Army the same thing. They ripped it all out and threw it away because they basically cook everything in one big pot, and it's very straightforward food. Afghan food, and it's not sustainable. They can't maintain that kitchen. They can't even get the gas to run the stoves. It's not feasible for them to do this. And so we set something up that it is not going to be able to be able. They won't be able to sustain this.
I don't see why. I mean, it's not that complicated to see, okay, here's this culture. We're going in deep to this culture. We want the support of this culture. Why is it we can't just find out what is, in fact, sustainable and what might be useful to them? I mean, it doesn't seem that complicated.
Because nobody makes any money. This is all about everybody's in on the take. I'm going to tell you about meeting a guy named Captain Douglas Seymour. I was out in gosh, Laghman province. This is another eastern province out on the Pakistani border. There's just, things are just blowing up all the time. And IEDs and attacks and quick reaction forces going out, howitzers going off day after day after day. We were on this little base called Meder Lam, and it had just, you know, it had been, nobody was getting much sleep. It was just rough. And this guy, Captain Douglas Seymour, was this big, tall, lantern-jawed guy. And as it turns out, he was an intelligence officer. His main work was working as a drug cop in Las Vegas. He was a detective. And so he starts talking to me early one morning. We were standing on the porch of these little plywood structures that are called bee huts. And KBR, you know, the people often know as a military-industrial company, they built tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of these things all over Afghanistan. Like the cheesiest thing you could ever imagine, made of sheets of plywood and 2x4s. It's not painted. There's seldom windows. You know, it's just the flimsiest thing imaginable. And we're standing on this porch, and Captain Seymour started talking to me, and he was pretty jaded, and he was pretty fried, and he said, you know, we've lost fewer soldiers here than we lose in training. He said, you know, this is a quote. He said, the Afghans know just the right amount of fighting to keep us here. Not too many casualties or we'll bolt. Can't let peace break out or we'll lose interest. Just the right amount. And then he started talking, I'd heard this tone. I'd heard this story so often, but he spoke in almost a poetic way to me, and I thought he really encapsulated it. So Captain Seymour said to me, this is again as a quote, the military, they get all these combat commands and combat patches. I get all this cool equipment. I started back when the Russians were the enemy. I never got all this cool equipment. The military-industrial complex, they're all making money, all this stuff. And he points back at this little delaminating plywood hut that we're standing in front of, a bee hut. And he said, what's that thing cost? $28,000 a hit for one of these. He said, it's a playhouse. The government here, the Karzai government, they're like the mafia, always getting their cut. The Taliban gets their cut. It's the perfect war. Everybody makes money.
Whoa. What about the Congress in these United States? I mean, they're supposed to watch out for the budget. You know, there's a lot of alleged conservatives in there who don't want us to be wasting money. Is Congress aware of the waste and corruption?
Well, they are, and there's been congressional investigations into it. But you've got to understand that the military-industrial complex, the development-industrial complex, the Beltway bandits, these are shareholders in Congress.
Of course.
And that's a term that a congressman told me. There is a sturdy band of congressional people that include Vermont Representative Peter Welch on both the right and the left. Representative Walter Jones, who is a very staunch conservative Republican from North Carolina. Representative Barbara Lee, who is the only woman who voted against the Iraq War, is a very liberal congresswoman from California. Peter Welch, Dennis Kucinich was in this group. They understand this, and there have been hair-raising investigations. But, you know, as a former USAID official pointed out to me, USAID has very few engineers, has very little capacity other than to write checks, because they figured out that they couldn't lobby. So what they did is they partnered with the Beltway Bandits, with the development organizations. They can lobby. They can contribute money to campaign. And that's how it works.
Oh, my goodness.
And so when these congressmen that understand this dysfunction, understand this horrific ways, they talk about these lobbyists that come and throng into their offices to distribute money.
Wow. If you just tuned in, quite a story. Funding the Enemy is the book. Funding the Enemy, How the U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Our guest today is investigative journalist Douglas Wissing, who's been all through Afghanistan, and as you say, it's just some hair-raising stories. And you know, being of my age, my generation, you know, I remember Vietnam when we didn't ask the people there, when it just came down on them and there was tremendous waste. Frankly, it sounds like there's even more waste now. And, you know, I'm thinking perhaps part of the problem with the U.S. war in Vietnam was that our policymakers had a definition of that conflict. They defined it as one between the good guys, the U.S., versus the bad guys controlled by the Soviet Union, which was, of course, completely false. It was just a totally wrong picture. Have we learned that lesson from that failure in Vietnam? Do we understand Afghanistan now as we didn't understand Vietnam?
Oh, no, it's worse. Oh, we don't understand the society. And Afghans across the board, from the members of the kleptocracy down to the tribal people that I spoke with in the villages, they're stunned at how little we understand this. This is a very complicated society.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opaque society, and you have to understand that we rotate people through. I mean, part of the problem of Afghanistan is that people just wanted to punch their tickets. These are careerists that want to move up the GS scale. These are people that want to run in as a private contractor and pick up $250,000 a year to be a plumber or an electrician. People who've got, you know, alimony problems, or, you know, and it's just, you know, a bunch of sour Americans out there, because you get a lot of money to be out there as a contractor. Security contractor, washed up special ops guy. You're in, you know, Blackwater's gone to three or four names now.
Right.
And now it's Academy and maybe a new one by now. You know, you get paid more money than you can imagine being a private security guy. And, yeah, that's the way
it's
going.
Is.
And everybody's in on the take. Everybody's making money.
Well, I got to ask you about this amazing photograph you took of a concrete wall with a spray-painted message on it. Tell us about that, if you would, please, Douglas.
Oh, this is actually, this was on Metar Lom. This was the same base where Captain Seymour told me about the perfect war. And I was out at the landing zone, this kind of bleak area just next to a hardscrabble cemetery where Afghan national soldiers are buried, a Muslim cemetery. And there were these jersey barriers, those kind of high concrete security things that you can bring in and drop with big forklifts and stuff. And the Hindu Kush was in the background, and I happened to glance over, and someone had come out in the middle of the night and had spray-painted onto these security barriers, "The game, you lost it."
The game, you lost it. Wow.
Yeah, let me tell you something that I found that the stories that the soldiers told me out there, they encapsulated in ways that I don't think I could ever come close to. And I was speaking to one Marine officer who was in southern Afghanistan who was just telling me just scandal after scandal after scandal, just billions being burned. And he said to me, this is a quote, "Among the Marines in Afghanistan, there's low morale. They say this is such a waste of time. This is a drug and tribal war. With the Pakistani and the Iranian intelligence involved, these people will never pull their heads out of there." Well, you can imagine what a Marine would say. Mm-hmm. And he said, "On an operational level, the soldiers are saying, I'm going to go over there and try to not get my legs blown off.
Right.
My nation will shut this down. That's the feeling of my fellow soldiers." And then he concluded, he said something that I'd heard soldiers tell me a lot. He said, "The juice ain't worth the squeeze."
Nah. Boy, that says it all. Douglas Wissing, is it over? Is it right now for us, the U.S., to just leave? Is it okay for us to do that? Isn't that a little bit irresponsible for us to just pack up and get out? Is it all over?
Well, I think that, one, the question we have to ask is what we're doing accomplishing our military and strategic goals? And I feel, based on what I have seen, what I have heard from hundreds and hundreds of people, what the summation that I get is no, we are not, we are wasting U.S. taxpayer dollars at a time, let's not forget, when there are a lot of domestic needs.
Oh, yeah.
President Obama has said rightfully so, it's time to do nation building here at home.
Yes.
So we're wasting billions. We are spending about $1.5 billion a week in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Today, people don't understand. We still have about 61,000 soldiers there with a lot of special ops that don't show up in that number, and probably one and a half times that number in private contractors. We're spending $1.5 billion a week and not accomplishing our goals. The Taliban is growing exponentially, double digits each year. And the old special forces dictum is, if an insurgency isn't shrinking, it's winning. It's been growing every year we've been there.
Mm.
We're at record levels of attacks, and they're not even trying. They're just holding back their forces because they know we're leaving in 2014.
Right.
Now, the thing I think the American taxpayers, the American citizens, have to really consider, and they really have to speak to their congressmen, and the soldiers are asking Americans to do this, is we have to understand we're still madly intent on signing contracts for these things. USAID is lining up staggeringly large contracts that will do almost nothing. $300 million for a women's empowerment project. But if it did something, I think we'd go, well, you know, that's a good goal. The problem is the Pashtun princesses, these politically empowered Afghans, they're lining up to grab it. The worst of the Beltway bandits are lining up to grab it. It will do virtually nothing to help your average Afghan woman. That is the great tragedy. $300 million. And I think of, I'm here in Vermont. I spoke with a woman who helps out pregnant women in need. And you know, she is a nurse and a social worker. She was telling me, she was like shaking, talking about a homeless mother, that there aren't funds to help out. She just, you know, I'm staying in Williamsville, Vermont. I turn onto a bridge that is falling down. It really, really needs to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
$300 billion and we have nothing to show for it.
Oh, my goodness. The book is...
This ain't worth the squeeze.
The juice ain't worth the squeeze. Douglas Wissing, the book is Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Who's the publisher?
This is published by a wonderful publisher, Prometheus Books. And
Prometheus,
I can also mention there's a lot of information about the book. There's photographs that I've taken in Afghanistan. There's links to a lot of articles that I've written on this subject. They're all at my website, www.douglaswissing.com.
Very informative. Not exactly uplifting, but very informative. Hey, thank you so much for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you, Bert.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. All at once, the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, Turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point anymore, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.